PRI, Public Radio International.
In the past, I was often amazed as we would make rounds in the coronary care units in the morning and would interrupt the patient's breakfast to find them happily eating two or three eggs, at times with bacon and butter on their toast. And we would look at each other and the patient in disbelief as, why are you eating this since this is what brought you here?
What's wrong with this picture? A lot of things, not just patients in trouble, but a medical system that has dangerously underemphasized prevention and a whole environment in which industry tempts and prods all of us to eat unhealthy foods. And another thing we've been fed is a lot of misinformation by schools and other agencies. How we fell into this trap, with the help of big lobbies, and a remarkably simple way out, agreed to by almost all caring health experts, this time on The Vegetable Chronicles. I'm David Freudberg. By now, you'd practically have to be living on another planet not to know that a low-fat diet with plenty of fruits, vegetables, and grains is the recommended way to eat for health and weight control. It dramatically cuts your risk of getting killer conditions like heart attack, cancer, diabetes, and stroke. Many factors influence our physical well-being, but unless you have a problem with tobacco or alcohol, diet may be the single most important health choice you make. It's just that eating is such a primal and passionate experience, and most of us struggle to keep our balance. New York Times nutrition reporter Marion Burroughs.
It's probably extremely significant in terms of its impact on your health, but people don't see it in black and white. These things are a matter of a lifetime, and it's very hard to convince people to change what they do because what you eat has a lot to do with more than just what it tastes like. It has to do with with emotion in your childhood and what your mother fed you. It has to do with so many other things. It's the hardest thing in the world to change.
Hey, how much would you pay for this 12-ounce choice flame-broiled New York strip sirloin? Before you answer, remember, you can only get them at the 99 restaurant, where you get great, friendly service.
Not only are people getting fatter in this country, but the fastest-growing segment in the restaurant business is the steakhouses. Don't forget, martinis are back, cigars are back. I know that's all a fad, but it's telling us something about how people feel. And they're saying, I've had enough of this. Leave me alone.
While people might resent food sermons, go into grocery stores like this one, and the shelves are lined with popular products that boast low-fat or fat-free contents, some of them tasting pretty bad. What's happened is that consumers are trying to cut back on dietary fat for health reasons, but are not yet really willing to take the next leap of shifting their fundamental food habits. Greg Drescher of Greystone, California, is education director at the Culinary Institute of America.
The thought was, all right, Americans want to eat hamburger, so let's take the hamburger, let's boil the saturated fat out of the hamburger, let's take their favorite cookies and turn them into snack well cookies. And let's really put our best food scientists on the task. And just as we've done with margarine and just as we've done with any number of foods, we'll engineer away our problems. And I think there are a number of problems with that. One is a lot of these new foods have not been tested particularly. Maybe they're tested for a few months, but they're not tested in whole populations over long periods of time. The larger issue with what I call techno-foods is taste. I find most of these foods are really unsatisfactory, and I think most people are eating them just because they think that they'll be healthier as a result.
The natural way to eat low-fat foods is what nutritionists and health experts call a plant-based diet, in which vegetables, fruits, beans, and grains assume the center of your plate, while fatty animal products like meat and dairy are kept to a minimum. Reflecting solid medical evidence for this choice, The American Cancer Society now formally recommends that you select most of the foods you eat from plant sources. But it's a message that could easily get drowned out.
This is a very good sign.
Since we opened our doors, McDonald's has been giving you great food at a great price. And the way we see it,
things are only looking better.
This is a heaping helping of a big beefy burger with bacon for 99 cents.
Can you believe it?
The massive fast food industry, with more than 150,000 restaurants throughout the United States, spends nearly $2 billion a year advertising a style of food that's carefully designed to titillate your taste buds, even if it's not very nourishing.
There's a lot to be said about the immediate allure of salt, sugar, and fat. It doesn't satisfy, but it's really tempting. And once you're onto that road, then it's hard to really understand a lot of other flavors, because those are really numbing kinds of flavors.
Rick Bayless is award-winning chef at the Toplobampo restaurant in Chicago and a food industry consultant.
In a way, I think it's the dumbing of the American taste bud. It's certainly not a progression forward. You have a big pot of greens next to a hamburger, fast food kind of hamburger, and the greens are going to have a wide variety of flavors there that take some getting used to if all you've experienced is that fast food hamburger.
Yeah, it's very satisfying food. It's greasy and salty, and what more can you ask?
Need a waffle with cheese, no onion, no tomato, extra pickle, extra lettuce.
Lunchtime on Saturday at a Burger King restaurant in suburban Boston. French fries cook in gurgling oil. Cheese melts onto steaming burgers, and a meaty aroma pervades the scene. Young children, who on this day comprise about a third of the customers, dance around wearing cardboard crowns emblazoned with the Burger King logo. Coin of the realm in this kingdom is very low price and nearly instant service.
What are you having for lunch today?
French fries, a Whopper Jr., and I had a chicken sandwich already.
That's all. How was it?
Horrible. I feel like the acid indigestion is already kicking in.
Why do you eat in a place like this if that's the reaction you get?
It's fast, it's quick, and I was starving to death, so I'm here.
Do you have any concerns about the nutritional qualities of the food served in a place like this?
Absolutely. Yeah, I can feel the grease on my tongue, and I don't think that's healthy.
Oh, I think it can be bad nutritionally if you overdo it, but once in a while I don't think it's bad at all.
What did you have today?
I had a Whopper, a big cheeseburger.
How was it?
It was good. I feel full, and that's good.
How many fast food meals do you have a week, would you say?
47. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
Is that true?
Yeah.
Are you at all concerned about the nutritional content?
I certainly am. My doctor told me to keep out of them.
So why do you eat here so often?
The only place I can afford.
Did your doctor tell you to keep out of places like these because of any particular medical condition or just as a general advice?
Medical condition, high blood pressure, but you have to eat something, and I'm not home to cook.
How tasty is it?
I have no taste buds anymore after eating this crap.
I think there's good nutrition with a little extra grease, oil, I should say.
So you think basically the food here is okay?
It's protein, it's potato. Yeah, I think it is.
I'm going to die, so I just want to, eat cheap and live, I could spend $10 on good food, or I could, spend $3 on bad food and put the $7 towards, Bud Dry is very cheap these days. The only reason why you're eating here is because it's fast.
Apart from the deep-fried potatoes, vegetable dishes are conspicuously absent from the menu. And that, say medical experts, is a recipe for trouble. Not only do high-fat meats, shakes, and fried foods increase your chance of getting the chronic diseases, but you miss out on the considerable protective effects of vegetables and fruits. There are now hundreds of studies from around the world showing that people who eat at least 5 daily servings of fruits and veggies dramatically lower their risk of cancer and other major killers. Physician Tim Byers was nutrition chief at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta.
You might say, well, maybe they don't smoke as much, or maybe they jog more, or
they're in better spiritual or psychological health. Those are all good possibilities. However, what's happened in the different studies as we've studied this, we've tried to measure carefully things like that, like family history of disease, smoking, obesity levels, levels of physical activity, and so forth. And we keep coming back to an important, independent, real effect of fruits and vegetables on better health and lower cancer risk, regardless of these other things.
It's very difficult to get people to change their diets.
Marion Burroughs of the New York Times.
It's very, very difficult to talk people into doing things that are good for them because it will improve their health and reduce their medical bills. They don't believe it. They don't believe it until they have a heart attack or they get cancer or diabetes or any one of those other diseases like that. Then they start to look at this.
For many years, Americans were raised to think that the healthiest diet was one that had a lot of meat and eggs and dairy products.
Bonnie Liebman of the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
And people throughout the 80s began to hear that they should be eating less fat, saturated fat, less cholesterol. They should be eating more fiber. They should cut back on salt. They knew that general advice, but they couldn't translate it into what to have for dinner tonight.
It seems to be a phenomenon all around the world that when people have money and have access to greater amounts of meat, they opt for that.
Greg Drescher at the Culinary Institute of America.
People seem to like the taste of meat. However, I think in this country that really has been fueled by various lobbying efforts. And also, I think, by a reticence on the part of the government to speak plainly about the need to eat less meat and to eat more fruits and vegetables. The messages are too often sort of choose lean meat, eat more lean meat.
American meat-eating habits have not been constant for the last 250 years. People did not get off the Mayflower eating tenderloin steaks. It's a mistake to suppose that they did. And our meat-eating habits have indeed changed.
Sidney Mintz is an anthropologist at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
I think, for instance, in my own case of being in the service from 1943 through part of 1946, we were given meat 21 times a week at every meal. And even on Friday night, there was meat to fall back upon if you didn't want to eat fish. And my memory of that is that I was, like most of my soldiers, a young man who had not eaten meat 21 times a week before I got into the service. I probably ate meat at the most 7 times a week. And I think we turned ourselves into much more a nation of meat eaters by that war than we had ever been before. We also, needless to add, turned us into a nation of cigarette smokers. We turned us into a nation of coffee drinkers and sugar users and so on and on, because war is a wonderful time to discipline one's population to eating what you want them to eat.
Sunday night, the American Meat Institute, on behalf of all those engaged in supplying meat to the nation, presents The Life of Riley with William Bendix as Riley. The meat people of America providing a great food for a great nation. This year, your meatpacking industry will probably process about 90 million hogs, the greatest number in history. That's a lot of pork, America. But our fighting forces and our folks at home will need it all. And now, The Life of Riley.
I think that meat eating in the United States has always been enhanced by the feeling that it expressed our difference from other peoples, our masculinity, our vigor, our love of life, our newness. A lot of symbolic messages were carried along with the meat and still are. It goes along with the kind of hunting attitude Americans have, the right to bear arms. A lot of different things are attached to the notion of meat eating. And that said, it's striking, of course, to see how it is possible for people to do with less meat, for instance, under medical advice, and in fact to feel quite good about it, to find that it's possible to live with less meat or with no meat at all, for that matter. In other parts of the world, meat generally is not served in large portions, in big slices, in slabs, in whole roasts, in gammons of ham, in legs. What one gets instead is small pieces of meat, often mixed with either a vegetable or a starch, and consumed as a way of making the basic food more appetizing.
This is Wendell Niles, a spokesman for your meat industry. When Mother puts the pot roast on, there's a smile on her lips and water in the mouth of everyone who likes honest Injun food and flavor. Be even gladder, pot roast people, for that lovely pot roast is packed with proteins. Not only proteins, but top-flight quality proteins. We can't see them, but our bodies sure need them to grow on, to keep in repair with, to keep fit on. In fact, all meat pot roast or pork chop, fresh, smoked, or canned, is a yardstick of protein foods, because meat measures up to every protein need.
The theme that meat and other animal products are an essential source of protein was a major selling point, not only for producers of those products, but also for public health messages during the 1940s and 50s.
This is Milton Cross bringing you another story of Empire County, presented by the New York State Department of Health and produced by the State Radio Bureau.
Billy insists on meat every night. That's why our bills are so high.
Well, you gotta have meat. Meat gives you protein. That builds up your body.
Sure it does. But meat isn't the only way to get protein. A pound of American cheese will give you as much protein as a pound and a half of meat and cost a lot less. Fish and eggs give you protein. So does poultry. So does milk.
Do we need
milk? Actually, the very first research I got involved in when I came to Harvard was to try to study protein requirements, because there was that assumption that maybe we would develop protein deficiency because of restrictions in the diet.
Dr. Mark Hegstead is nutrition professor emeritus at Harvard University.
We concluded that that was not true, that people could get along very well on a vegetarian diet. I think that's true. And obviously the emphasis on protein has diminished a lot, but that was a very important nutrient in those days.
Is it your point that we don't need a high-protein diet?
Yeah, I don't think we need a high-protein diet. The issue now is almost whether excess protein is detrimental.
Today, the UN's World Health Organization lists the human protein requirement at just 5% of total calories consumed, a level easily met by moderate intake of fruits, vegetables, beans, and grains. During World War II, the enormous effort to supply meat to the armed forces and to Allied nations facing wartime food shortages provided a bonanza for the American meat industry. It also caused the domestic meat supply to shrink, prompting several major American cities to urge the public to conserve. But the reaction of the powerful livestock farmers, sensitive to any suggestion that consumers cut back on buying meat, foreshadowed a battle royale that would play out in the 1970s. Here's a 1944 recording from New York City.
Our speaker, the Honorable F.H. LaGuardia, Mayor of the City of New York.
People of this country must realize that we will have to be more prudent as we go along in the use of food. The Meatless Tuesday is working out very satisfactorily in New York City, and other cities are adopting it. I can tell you an amusing little incident about that. When we started Meatless Tuesday in New York City, Morris, the Secretary of Agriculture, thought it was fine, told me it was fine, and we started, and then we got a terrible howl from the livestock producers out in the West, and they went to Washington and said, hey, well, why is this necessary? And Washington says, at that time, about 3 months ago, why, well, says, it isn't necessary, it's just one of LaGuardia's ideas. And then I got it again. And then Washington telling me, keep it up, it's all right. So I think Washington ought to be consistent in telling both the producers and the retailers and the consumers the same story at the same time. I think that would be very helpful to all mayors.
As hostilities raged through Europe, meat shortages there may have been responsible for a rather unexpected trend. Health authorities noticed a decline in certain diseases, even amidst the stressful conditions of war. Harvard nutritionist Mark Hegsted.
That was one of the theses that was proposed fairly shortly after World War II to explain what had happened in various parts of Europe, where it was clear the incidence of heart attacks and also of diabetes went down and then began to rebound after the war. So I think that set the stage for the all kinds of studies that were pursued right after the war in terms of heart disease particularly.
Groundbreaking research was conducted by University of Minnesota professor Ansel Keys, who studied the Mediterranean diet, which includes few fatty animal products and plentiful portions of fresh fruits, vegetables, and grains. It's also a region where heart disease, now the leading killer of Americans, was virtually unknown.
More and more evidence accumulated, demonstrating a relationship between high-fat diets and heart disease.
Marion Nessel chairs the nutrition department at New York University.
And that information was taken by the American Heart Association and published as dietary recommendations for heart disease prevention starting in the late 1950s. There also was beginning to be increasing a body of information about a relationship of dietary patterns and cancer risk. That was coming out. And there were dietary patterns and hypertension and stroke risk, so that it became clear that dietary patterns that contained a lot of fat, saturated fat, cholesterol, salt, and sugar and alcohol were associated with a whole variety of chronic diseases. And there was a lot of information out there in those years.
15 billion hot dogs are consumed annually by Americans.
Consumer advocate Ralph Nader testifying before Congress, August 1969.
If we accept reputable and repeated medical studies and judgment linking high-fat diet to higher blood cholesterol levels, which are in turn connected with the rising incidence of heart and coronary disease, the nation's leading cause of death, then these 15 billion hot dogs are among America's deadliest missiles.
Emerging knowledge that a high-fat diet can be hazardous to your health was not embraced at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The USDA's mandate is to represent farmers, including the influential producers of meat, dairy, and eggs. These industries enjoy a guaranteed market through the federally funded school lunch program, which now reaches more than 90,000 schools. And a perspective favorable to industry was depicted in USDA nutrition films.
Oh, Humpty Dumpty really fell today. Now, here's a hard one. It's estimated that there are 30 million school children in the United States. How many gallons of milk would it take to give each of them 1/2 pint every school day for 1 year if the school year is 200 days? Joe?
Well, for 1/2 pint for 200 days for each of them, that would be, there's 8 pints in a gallon, so that would be 12.5 gallons per year for each of them, and 12.5 times 30 is 375, and that times a million is 375 million gallons of milk.
Right, and I hope you're drinking your share.
And incidentally, Mr. Kelly, sometimes I drink some of that every day I'm in school.
Well, great. And later on, I'm going to tell you just how important that is. But now, here's one of those deep questions.
Throughout the 60s and 70s, the USDA continued to showcase its basic four food groups: dairy, meat, fruits and vegetables as a third group, and grains as the fourth. Despite rising evidence that excessive consumption of two of the groups, dairy and meat, posed a serious health risk, this was not clarified in materials widely distributed to school children by the USDA and the National Dairy Council. Agribusiness had exerted its muscle. In Washington, Bonnie Liebman edits the Nutrition Action Health Letter, published by the Center for Science in the Public Interest.
as recently as the 1970s, the National Dairy Council was the biggest source of nutrition education materials in the country's schools.
And how do you feel about that? Is that a conflict of interest to your eyes?
Absolutely. The industries that are selling us food should not be telling us which kinds of foods are healthy. That's a basic conflict of interest.
Director of the Center for Science in the Public Interest is Michael Jacobson.
Even though diet and lack of exercise cause as many deaths as cigarette smoking each year, this country seems to have taken a stand on cigarette smoking and said, let's try to prevent kids from smoking, let's educate the whole public, and I think we're having some effect in that area. But with nutrition, too many lobbies, too hard to do, too many, you know, there are only a few tobacco states. Practically every state is a beef state, a dairy state, a grain state, or something. So it's a much, much tougher area to work in, and unfortunately, there's been very little progress.
You're listening to the Vegetable Chronicles. I'm David Freud.
In a moment, a look at the sharp clash when Senator George McGovern's Nutrition Committee urged Americans to cut back on animal products and consume more fruits, vegetables, and grains, and how 20 years later, science has now discovered potent disease-fighting properties in those fruits and veggies. If you'd like to order the Vegetable Chronicles on audio cassette tape, please call toll-free 1-800-5-LISTEN. That's 1-800-5-LISTEN. Thank you. This is PRI, Public Radio International.